Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains references to rather graphic situations of violence and death, hospital scenario and complete mental breakdowns and people disappearing and military shenanigans that are not great.
And hellish bureaucracy.
Yeah, just, yeah, very harmful patterns of bureaucracy. But yes, also, and we discuss the weather. Sorry.
Hey, folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us as we continue with Catch-22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 34, Thanksgiving. You know, every time I hear the word Thanksgiving now, I think of the Grindhouse movie by Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, because it had a bunch of fake trailers by other horror creators. And I believe it was Eli Roth did one called Thanksgiving, because there was, in the 80s, like, holiday-themed slasher movies were a subgenre. But
it sounds like someone was trying to process some sort of family issues.
Well, it's just got this deep voice that's always going, Thanksgiving, white meat, dark meat, all will be carved, Thanksgiving. So that's what comes to mind now whenever I hear the name of that holiday.
I see.
A rare glimpse into how odd my brain is.
Well, look, it's associating itself, associating with something that was tickling your humor bone.
And yeah. All the fake trailers. Actually, to my mind, that's the best part of the whole Grindhouse thing. Mm-hmm. So, Rue, how you doing?
Hey, so. Mm. Processing life. It's becoming warmer.
Yes, it is. I because we've had okay. So this is our obligatory talk about the weather. Segment. What happened over the past couple of days, we had wild, unpredictable storms, which, I mean, it is storm season, so I believe we mentioned that last time. Yes. This is the obligatory, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, warning. Yes. I was talking to a friend, actually, about how that's probably the most said phrase out of everything.
Probably mentioned this, but we can't remember.
But, yeah, so, you know, before I went into work yesterday, I looked at the weather app on my phone, and it said the storms weren't happening till long after I left. Like, you know, I got there at 9 a.m., and it said, oh, it's not going to storm till 4 p.m. And I'm like, cool, I'll leave my windows down a squidge, you know, so the sun doesn't burn my car. That's what I do. Well, I get into work, and pretty much like a minute later, torrential downpour, and I was just like, well, I've left my windows open a squidge, so hopefully it's not too bad. So what I do, yeah, I go out, and yeah, there was a lot of water, like, over the inside of the doors, kind of, you know, sprinkled down the window. And my car smells a little ranky now. But aside from that, it was good. But because of what happened yesterday, I looked at my app today, and it said, oh, no storms till the afternoon. I'm like, ha, 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 fool me once, shame on me, or, you know, however that goes. So I decide to leave my windows up, and I get back, and it's just been baking the whole day. And I open my car, and it's like, steam! So yeah, you can't win, or maybe the lesson there is,
you can't
don't trust the phone weather app.
It's an estimate at best. Rough. In the meantime, though, did you hear about what happened in Mackay?
No.
Mackay is a fair few hours north of us, I should point out. Mackay, I'm trying to think, it'd be about 14, if not more, hours north of us. It's quite a bit up north.
Well, I mean, for those unaware, Queensland is a huge state. We're talking like, you know, what, like five Texases could fit in Queensland?
I can't even remember, but it's massive. Like, it's the from the bottom of the border with New South Wales up to the top, up to York, if not, well, yeah, Cook, I guess. So up to the right to the top. It's okay, so it's 2.5 hours flight ish to get to Cairns from Brisbane, not from the Gold Coast, mind you.
And also, we live in southeast Queensland, we live pretty much right in the tiniest corner of the state.
Yeah, we're in the small corner, and then if you but the most densely populated, but
most of the state, like most of Australia, is just land.
Well. Yes,
sun
it's,
and
it's
land.
Not as densely. It's not as densely populated, but it's then getting up to the top. It takes like another. I can't remember. It's huge. Like the day, like yeah, nonstop driving. Maybe 27 hours. I want to say. I don't know. I can't remember. I once looked it up on the Google Maps for interest, and I went, okay, so that's a. Bit of a distance, but it's a huge state. I mean, it's no Western Australia, which is a whole nother discussion.
I mean, that is the largest state in the country, right?
Yeah, well, in our Commonwealth, yeah, or Federation or whatever we are.
Well, because I remember back, would have been like 10, 11, maybe even more years ago, me and my friend Andrew drove up to Rockhampton to attend a wedding, and we decided to do like a scenic inland route. On the way back, we came down the coast road because, you know, fast coast road. And this was before the coast roads were good. Like, you know, there's been a lot of upgrades to our
they've been
highway
improved.
Networks.
Yeah. They've been improved. I have memories.
I believe it was an 8-hour drive. And when you look at the map, Rockhampton looks like it's close to Brisbane.
Yeah, Rocky's relatively close. I mean, it took us, I think, 14 hours on a bus once.
Train, like
10 hours.
8-hour drive. Oof. I mean, it was fun, you know, being with a friend and checking out landscape, stopping for snacks, listening to CDs, because this was before, you know, we had a large streaming services.
Options, no. Mm. But yeah, so up in Mackay on Tuesday, I say this because I have a friend that I try and catch up with once or twice a week, and we talk research and stats and doing that kind of fun things. He's a doctor, so yeah. And we had to cancel because on Tuesday, their power got knocked out.
Mm.
There was a tornado.
Oh.
There was hail. So now the record for hail has now been broken. We used to, there was 14 centimeter hail previously as our record. We have now gone up to 16 centimeters that has been recorded. That is the size of a very large mango. Like, chunky. That's a chunky piece of hail.
I know people who like mangoes love mangoes, but you wouldn't want a mango falling out of the sky on you.
Made of ice and hitting terminal velocity at about 100 meters.
Yeah.
So, no, it's bad.
Mango terminal velocity.
It's pretty bad. But yeah, so it's yeah, so, and then I just saw the news today, just a few hours ago this morning at the Brisbane airport, they had another mini tornado. We've had a few little mini tornadoes kind of almost touching down and some that did touch down. We do get them in northern New South Wales. It does happen. There's patches in Australia where it happens. And it does happen occasionally. Townsville got hit by a bit of a doozy a few years ago. But that's also the way the layout of the country kind of feeds to that, because there's an island and a channel and stuff. It's highly unusual for us to get supercell storms that are that intense that they will give us a tornado.
Mm.
Like, that kind of rate is unusual,
and
within the same week.
It feels like we've had a lot more hail warnings than are usual.
We've had a lot of hail warnings. So one of the aspects, and to those listeners who are maybe on the fence or not simpatico with the concept of climate change, you can cover your ears now. It's definitely it's an outcome of the shift in terms of the climate patterns, in terms of how we are contributing towards a change in these weather patterns, which is kind of disturbing. But it's something that we were warned about.
Mm-hmm.
it's just not something that's being consciously prepared for.
Yep.
And in terms of infrastructure and damage, and we don't really have shelters, like the schools end up being our shelters, which is all good and well, but if the schools aren't designed well, that's also not going to help us. I don't think I've ever heard a siren on the Gold Coast, except if you were in certain spots where you were near, like, I've only heard a siren once, and that was because the bushfire was near the university.
Oh.
And I happened to be at the university at the time, trying to wrap up some things and backing up all my data onto a hard drive so I could take them home, just in case. Because our alcohol storage tanks used to be right next to the bush.
I'm happy to hear it used to be.
Used to be, because now we've taken that part of the bush away and moved it a bit further away, and I think they've moved the storage tanks, but also gas storage tanks, some of them were close to, like, a bit built, and yeah, so there were some issues in terms of safety. What was funnier was that our safety, you know, the spot where you emergency assembly area, one of them was right next to where the gas tanks were being stored.
Oh, God.
And as researchers, we all kind of looked at each other saying, so we're all in agreement that we are going to be gathering at the other safety assembly area, right? So every time there was an emergency thing, like, you know, either a drill or someone accidentally left one of the Bunsen burners on in the teaching lab beneath us, that was a thing. And someone stored some cleaning things together that shouldn't have been kept together, and they kind of smoldered. Didn't start a fire, but the smoke kind of triggered off the alarm. Anyway, so little incidents like that. We, the emergency, our fire warden refused to take us to that emergency point. So when security came, they were looking for us. It was like, we'd wave at them from the other point, and they'd be like, what are you doing up there? The point's here. It's like, gas tanks right there. If it's a fire, we're not standing next to them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So great when the people who actually understand the science aren't consulted in terms of safety.
That's quite an oversight.
Oh, we had a few. But at least my favorite one was still where we couldn't control the temperature of the lab unless we called off campus and called the other campus, because the other campus wanted to control, didn't want to lose the jobs in the other campus. So they wanted to control all the campuses, all the air conditioning in all the campuses. And we pointed out, it's a research lab. It has to stay at X temperature the entire time. You can't just switch it on and off for power saving. You can do it in the offices. That's fine. That can be motion sensor or whatever, or a button that we push. That's fine. But not the labs. And eventually, it only took 5 to 6 years.
Oh, jeez. Bureaucracy.
There's so many things. So many things. We had another one where imagine this, a large air conditioning unit that was basically designed for an entire floor, but it was in a tiny, tiny tea room.
So it was Arctic.
Well, yes, we used to nickname it Antarctica, and it would blast icy cold air in winter and steaming hot in summer, and we couldn't figure out why until someone pointed out that the temperature sensor that was going and giving feedback to the other campus where they were controlling things was right underneath the output. And so it was getting really wonky feedback. Anyway, we eventually argued the point that we needed a button in that room so we could switch it on and off. But again, that one took a while, and they eventually replaced the air conditioner with something that didn't freeze people. Like, you couldn't keep a cup of hot coffee in there without it going ice cold within maybe a minute, two.
Wow.
It was really, really, it was off the charts.
Hey, listeners, if you have any hilarious stories about bureaucratic nightmares, please let us know.
It's very thematic, given the whole
I was thinking that as you were talking about how your aircon controls were up at another campus, I'm like, yeah, bureaucracy, isn't it? Hey, that's a link to Catch-22.
It is, and it's funny because it took us years of, and we finally convinced them after we would send them a picture, like a series of pictures of us taking a photo of the temperature. We say, what's the temperature right now according to you? And they'd be like, this is the temperature. We're like, yeah. So according to the thermometer right now, take a picture. No, that is not the temperature. They finally believed us after an entire building told them that it needed to change.
That's something, it's not related completely to bureaucracy, but it's probably the reason why there's so much issue with it. But it seems there's just an issue with people not believing what other people say.
There's that, but there's also, I don't want to change what I've always been doing because that's what I got told I have to do.
There is that, yeah.
There's a lot of this kind of, you don't want to be the person that stands out. We have, actually, that's the thing that's culturally a thing in Australia where tall poppy syndrome is a thing.
Yeah, the tall poppy gets cut down.
That being said, I don't have an issue with humility. Humility is good as long as it's not used as where others dismiss what you could contribute,
well, yeah, if I'm making sense. The problem, the general problem is usually the insecurity of, oh, you trying to better yourself. What, you think you're better than us?
There's that, but there's also the making, like tooting your own horn is not a thing that is encouraged. In fact, if someone toots their own horn, in at least in Australia, it's generally not a good sign. That like some people get away with it, but they are not well liked. I mean, I don't think they'd be well liked anywhere. But if there's that, just that I'm better than, like it comes across as I am better than you.
Yeah.
And it's it's generally not appreciated. But then you've got also the incredibly insecure. Well, not going to share that one. But the incredible insecurity that comes with someone having to preempt every time they share anything. Well, in my experience as XYZ, as a teacher of 70 years, and you know that kind of, you're like, and I appreciate you have that expertise. Thank you for your insight. And then just leaving it be rather than going, oh, everything you say must be absolutely spot on and couldn't possibly be improved by looking at different perspectives and actually learning from them. There's a lot of insecurity that comes across as I've been doing this and this and this and this and I am this and that and that. And that's usually why we associate it. We associate it with either someone who's trying to show off or someone who is really insecure.
Yeah,
so it's interesting culturally speaking how there's a shift. I'm sure that's a universal-ish situation.
Yeah, well, you know, but, yeah. Standing out casts a light upon you.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, how you stand out is not always. You want to be distinct, I guess, in terms of you want to have. There's, I'm not saying the quote, I'm paraphrasing like a quote that I'd like, the kind of distinction you want to have is that you are living by the values that you claim to live by. That makes sense. Yeah. You want to be distinct in that, like, your word is your bond or that you have integrity and stuff, as opposed to distinct because, I don't know. I'm trying to think of, like,
You got a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money, your control, you were born power.
With, really good looks.
Yeah, it's like, It's nice that you are looks, you know, looks are not reliable. You can't tell what's going to happen. Wealth can go in a blink of an eye. It's not your accomplishment, really. I mean, success, material success, great, but it's also a reflection of the world that you are currently, like, the circles that you are in as well.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking in terms of Cathcart. Like, he's distinct. Like, he's trying to be distinct. He's trying to stand out, right?
It's just that all his ideas are terrible.
Well, yeah, in an effort to stand out and to look as though he's doing something that's innovative, no one else would ever do. There's a reason no one else would ever do that, because there are consequences. It's not a good idea.
Well, I mean, you know, the it's not a theme. It's not really, maybe it's best to call it plot, but what's been happening over the last few chapters now is the main through line has been the level of missions is taking its toll on Yessarian, along with losing quite a lot of people he cared about. And the way things are going, it's probably going to get worse and maybe not get better.
No, and they keep bringing in new people that have no experience, whilst making those people who have experience just stay there and continue to suffer, whilst the new people are shrugging, going, I don't know what you're on about. Is that, it's all fun. So that whole McWatt attitude.
And the thing is, and look what happened to him. But the thing as well, because it does make me think about the idea of, you know, pushing yourself, nose to grindstone, that kind of mentality. And my thought, because I'm a person who's never really actually had that much energy to put towards that kind of thing, is, if you have the energy and you have the drive, sure, go for it. But, you know, if I, and I'm sure you're the same, Rue, knowing, you know, we've known each other for a long time, but if you push yourself and you push yourself past healthy limits, that's going to take a great toll on you, and it's probably going to be worse in the long run. It would be better. Let's take it like Cathcart's troops. If he shot them out, even if Ysarion and Hungry Joe and that whole group, like, let's say they're the best flyers in the entire American war effort. If they tapped out at 25 missions, well, they could always come back for another tour another time after they've all recuperated and had their leave or whatnot, the ones that did want to come back. And if they did, you'd still have that great group and you'd have them again. But by continuing to push them, your great group is now running on fumes and they're not doing what they're capable of.
And that's the thing, like, it's, that's in any workplace, but I know that with as far as I've understood, and I might be completely wrong, and I acknowledge and accept that, with the military, the idea is that you can choose to go on tours, that a tour is a certain amount of, say, combat flights. Mm. And that was what the understanding was, that you do your tour, and then you go back, and then they decide whether they're going to deploy you for, like, they ask, would you like to do another tour? Are you up for another tour? So it's that kind of...
Or maybe you do have an obligation of so many tours, but you do have that downtime between.
Yes. Although I've heard stories from folks that were very much the catch-22 kind of situation just go, they change on the fly what a completed tour means.
So basically Cathcart is a real thing that still happens in the military.
Yeah. Or they just say, well, you were meant to have 2 weeks off, but we actually need to deploy you XYZ, so you're going to do your next tour now.
I wonder if they call it Cathcarting.
Should, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's just being dodgy. That's what it is. It's, you knew what you signed up for. Well, that's the whole point. No, you're changing the rules.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's and also I suspect they don't necessarily communicate, you know, the fine print. Mm-hmm. It's really challenging and pushing without. We know it's not actually an effective method, and it inherently, it's like a bridge. If you know the bridge can handle a certain amount of, for 10 years, it can handle this many cars driving over or this many tons of weight to go on it and under it and whatever, you have to maintain the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, at some stage, there's going to be cars on it and it'll crack and there'll be a major engineering incident.
And to further that metaphor, let's say it's built to withstand maybe, okay, things don't work this way, but just go with this analogy. Let's say it's able to withstand 50 cars driving over it a day. You know, once in a blue moon, maybe it can do 60, 70, maybe even 100 once a year, that kind of thing. But, you know, you can't sustain... sustain an overdrive.
No. And it's like with your car. Like there's a certain amount of fuel efficiency. If you don't maintain your tires and your car, then it becomes less efficient and eventually higher risk of something going really wrong. Mm. So we have all these things. There's a reason that we have, you're meant to maintain, you're meant to, they say using within manufacturer, the intended use is manufacturer's. There's a reason for that.
Mm.
I mean, there's also planned obsolescence, but that's a whole other discussion. But in this case, we're talking about humans are capable of a lot more and can push themselves. But in terms of the long-term effects and consequences and whether this is something that is sustainable and actually worth it in the long run.
Well, going back to talking about me and my energy levels, it's like,
yes.
What would you rather have? Would like, talk about Dave being able to output, you know. Would you like to have Dave at 60% for 20 years? Or would you like him at 100% for 6 months and then you don't get him anymore because he crashes?
Yeah. Yes. And I think that's the other thing is that we don't... You can build up your capacity as well. Like, if you... I don't know. I'm trying, like, for me, it's like... It just like with some people with a marathon, if you just immediately go and just say, okay, I'm going to train for a marathon.
You can build.
Yeah. Like, you might be able to run a marathon. Someone might be able to totally run a marathon and with very little preparation. Highly unlikely. But maybe they do the marathon, but that's it. Like, they've wrecked their body and they can't necessarily do it again.
Also, the experience would most likely suck, so they would never want to do it again.
Exactly. So, alternatively, if you've got someone who builds up and maybe does the 5 kilometer walk and then does the 10 kilometer walk and maybe 5 kilometers walking, 5 kilometers running, then they build up.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely, it becomes something that is then. You know, it's also something that allows you to learn and explore and get to know yourself better, and but also enables you to actually participate.
And those kind of gains, this is more to do with health, like training to run a marathon and eating well and sleeping well. It's the idea of the little pebble at the top of the hill turning into an avalanche by the time you get to the bottom.
Yeah.
It can take time. But yeah, from the small sustained steps forward will eventually yield greatness.
Yeah.
Consistency is the main key. That's where I struggle a lot. That is also interplayed with energy and reserves.
Yeah.
Discipline's another one, because I think of that like a muscle as well. You know, you got to build up your ability to be able to.
There's two really interesting series or books or courses that exist on this concept, which is one is Tiny Habits. The other one is Atomic Habits, which is similar, not quite the same, similar. And another one is Whoop, which is wish, objective, obstacle,
plan. I'm familiar with that. I just like the way you said Whoop.
Whoop. So there's a whole bunch. There's, and it's interesting because nothing is going to be foolproof and nothing is going to be 100% how your brain or your motivation, all that works. But it's also fun to explore. But I think we can all agree that the approach that is being employed here by Cathcart is incredibly harmful. Aside from morale, like the risks that people are taking, the mental state that these poor characters are going through is not good.
Oh, it's terrible. But and at the end of last chapter, we found out that Yossarian punched Nately in the nose. And I think that must have happened on Thanksgiving. So why don't we find out why that happened and if there's any fallout from that?
Then on we go.
Chapter 34, Thanksgiving. It was actually all Sergeant Knight's fault that Yossarian busted Nately in the nose on Thanksgiving Day, after everyone in the squadron had given humble thanks to Milo for providing the fantastically opulent meal on which the officers and enlisted men had gorged themselves insatiably all afternoon, and for dispensing like inexhaustible largesse the unopened bottles of cheap whiskey he handed out unsparingly to every man who asked. Even before dark, young soldiers with pasty white faces were throwing up everywhere and passing out drunkenly on the ground. The air turned foul. Other men picked up steam as the hours passed, and the aimless, riotous celebration continued. It was a raw, violent, guzzling Saturnalia that spilled obstreperously through the woods to the officers' club and spread up into the hills towards the hospital and the anti-aircraft gun emplacements. I love the word Saturnalia. There were fistfights in the squadron and one stabbing. Corporal Coligny shot himself through the leg in the intelligence tent while playing with a loaded gun, and had his gums and toes painted purple in the speeding ambulance as he lay on his back with the blood spurting from his wound. Men...
They are so incompetent. But yes, okay.
Hey, it's what was it, Gus and Wes?
Yeah, either way.
Without Dr. Nika's supervision.
Well, yeah. Because he's dead, apparently.
Men with cut fingers, bleeding heads, stomach cramps, and broken ankles came limping penitently up to the medical tent to have their gums and toes painted purple by Gus and Wes and be given a laxative to throw into the bushes.
Just checking something. Milo gives them a lot of food.
And
unopened bottles of cheap whiskey. And before dark, they start to throw up.
Hmm.
Something's up with that whiskey.
Or the food. Or both.
Or the food. Or both. Really, it's Milo.
The joyous celebration lasted long into the night, and the stillness was fractured often by wild, exultant shouts and by the cries of people who were merry or sick. There was the recurring sound of retching and moaning, of laughter, greetings, threats and swearing, and of bottles shattering against rock. There were dirty songs in the distance. It was worse than New Year's Eve. Yessarian went to bed early for safety and soon dreamed that he was fleeing almost headlong down an endless wooden staircase, making a loud staccato clatter with his heels. Then he woke up a little and realized someone was shooting at him with a machine gun. A tortured, terrified sob rose in his throat. His first thought was that Milo was attacking the squadron again, and he rolled off his cot to the floor and lay underneath in a trembling, praying ball, his heart thumping like a drop forge, his body bathed in a cold sweat. There was no noise of planes. A drunken, happy laugh sounded from afar. "Happy New Year! Happy New Year!" A triumphant, familiar voice shouted hilariously from high above, between the short, sharp bursts of machine gun fire. And the Assyrian understood that some men had gone as a prank to one of the sandbagged machine gun emplacements Milo had installed in the hills after his raid on the squadron and staff with his own men.
Ooh. But wait, what?
So after his attack of the squadron was unsuccessful, it looks like he's built secret machine gun nests around the squadron.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yessarian blazed with hatred and wrath when he saw he was the victim of an irresponsible joke that had destroyed his sleep and reduced him to a whimpering hulk. He wanted to kill. He wanted to murder. He was angrier than he had ever been before. Angrier even then when he had slid his hands around McWatt's neck to strangle him. The gun opened fire again. Voices cried, "Happy New Year!" And gloating laughter rolled down from the hills through the darkness like a witch's glee. In moccasins and coveralls, Yessarian charged out of his tent for revenge with his .45, ramming a clip of cartridges up into the grip and slamming the bolt of the gun back to load it. He snapped off the safety catch and was ready to shoot. He heard Nate Lee running after him to restrain him, calling his name. The machine gun opened fire once more from a black rise above the motor pool, and orange tracer bullets skimmed like low gliding dashes over the tops of the shadowy tents, almost clipping the peaks. Roars of rough laughter rang out again between the short bursts. Yessarian felt resentment boil like acid inside him. They were endangering his life, the bastards! With blind, ferocious rage and determination, he raced across the squadron past the motor pool, running as fast as he could, and was already pounding up into the hills along the narrow winding path when Nate Lee finally caught up, still calling, "Yo-Yo! Yo-Yo!" with pleading concern and imploring him to stop. He grasped Yessarian's shoulders and tried to hold him back. Yessarian twisted free, turning. Nate Lee reached for him again, and Yessarian drove his fist squarely into Nate Lee's delicate young face as hard as he could, cursing him, then drew his arm back to hit him again. But Nate Lee had dropped out of sight with a groan and lay curled up on the ground with his head buried in both hands and blood streaming between his fingers. Yessarian whirled and plunged ahead up the path without looking back. Soon he saw the machine gun. Two figures leaped up in silhouette when they heard him and fled into the night with taunting laughter before he could get there. He was too late. Their footsteps receded, leaving the circle of sandbags empty and silent in the crisp and windless moonlight. He looked about dejectedly. Jeering laughter came to him again from a distance. A twig snapped nearby. Yessarian dropped to his knees with a cold thrill of elation and aimed. He heard a stealthy rustle of leaves on the other side of the sandbags and fired two quick rounds. Someone fired back at him once, and he recognized the shot. "Dunbar?" he called. "Yessarian?" The two men left their hiding places and walked forward to meet in the clearing with wary disappointment, their guns down. They were both shivering slightly from the frosty air and wheezing from the labor of their uphill rush. "The bastards," said Ysarion. "They got away. They took 10 years off my life," Dunbar exclaimed. "I thought that son of a bitch Milo was bombing us again. I've never been so scared. I wish I knew who the bastards were. One was Sergeant Knight. Let's go kill him." Dunbar's teeth were chattering. He had no right to scare us that way. Ysarion no longer wanted to kill anyone. "Let's help Knightley first. I think I heard him at the bottom of the hill." But there was no sign of Knightley along the path, even though Ysarion located the right spot by the blood on the stones. Knightley was not in his tent either, and they did not catch up with him until the next morning when they checked into the hospital as patients after learning he had checked in with a broken nose the night before. Knightley beamed in frightened surprise as they padded into the ward in their slippers and robes behind Nurse Kramer and were assigned to their beds. Knightley's nose was in a bulky cast, and he had two black eyes. He kept blushing giddily in shy embarrassment and saying he was sorry when Ysarion came over to apologize for hitting him. Ysarion felt terrible. He could hardly bear to look at Knightley's battered countenance. Even though the sight was so comical, he was tempted to guffaw. Dunbar was disgusted by their sentimentality, and all three were relieved when Hungry Joe came barging in unexpectedly with his intricate black camera and trumped up symptoms of appendicitis to be near enough to Ysarion to take pictures of him feeling up Nurse Duckett. Like Ysarion, he was soon disappointed. Nurse Duckett had decided to marry a doctor, any doctor, because they all did so well in business. It would not take chances in the vicinity of the man who might someday be her husband. Hungry Joe was irate and inconsolable until, of all people, the chaplain was led in wearing a maroon corduroy bathrobe, shining like a skinny lighthouse with a radiant grin of self-satisfaction too tremendous to be concealed. The chaplain had entered the hospital with a pain in his heart that the doctors thought was gas in his stomach, and with an advanced case of Wisconsin shingles. "What in the world are Wisconsin shingles?" asked Ysarion. "That's just what the doctors wanted to know," blurted out the chaplain proudly, and burst into laughter. No one had ever seen him so waggish or so happy. "There's no such thing as Wisconsin shingles, don't you understand? I lied. I made a deal with the doctors. I promised that I would let them know when my Wisconsin shingles went away if they would promise not to do anything to cure them. I never told a lie before. Isn't it wonderful?" The chaplain had sinned, and it was good. Common sense told him that telling lies and defecting from duty were sins. On the other hand, everyone knew that sin was evil, and that no good could come from evil. But he did feel good. He felt positively marvelous. Consequently, it followed logically that telling lies and defecting from duty could not be sins. The chaplain had mastered, in a moment of divine intuition, the handy technique of protective rationalization, and he was exhilarated by his discovery. It was miraculous. It was almost no trick at all, he saw, to turn vice into virtue and slander into truth, impotence into abstinence, arrogance into humility, plunder into philanthropy, thievery into honor, blasphemy into wisdom, brutality into patriotism, and sadism into justice. Anybody could do it. It required no brains at all. It merely required no character. Wow. Oh, that's so good.
They've broken him.
With effervescent agility, the chaplain ran through the whole gamut of orthodox immoralities, while Knightley sat up in bed with flushed elation, astounded by the mad gang of companions of which he found himself the nucleus. He was flattered and apprehensive, certain that some severe official would soon appear and throw the whole lot of them out like a pack of bums. No one bothered them. In the evening, they all trooped exuberantly out to see a lousy Hollywood extravaganza in Technicolor. And when they trooped exuberantly back in after the lousy Hollywood extravaganza, the soldier in white was there, and Dunbar screamed and went to pieces. "He's back!" Dunbar screamed. "He's back! He's back!" Ysarion froze in his tracks, paralyzed as much by the eerie shrillness in Dunbar's voice as by the familiar white morbid sight of the soldier in white covered from head to toe in plaster and gauze. A strange, quavering, involuntary noise came bubbling from Ysarian's throat. "He's back!" Dunbar screamed again. "He's back!" a patient delirious with fever echoed in automatic terror. All at once, the ward erupted into bedlam. Mobs of sick and injured men began ranting incoherently and running and jumping in the aisle as though the building were on fire. A patient with one foot and one crutch was hopping back and forth swiftly in panic, crying, "What is it? What is it? Are we burning? Are we burning? He's back!" Someone shouted at him. "Didn't you hear him? He's back! He's back!" "Who's back?" shouted someone else. "Who is it? What does it mean? What should we do? Are we on fire? Get up and run, damn it! Everybody get up and run!" Everybody got out of bed and began running from one end of the ward to the other. One CID man was looking for a gun to shoot one of the other CID men who had jabbed his elbow into his eye. The ward had turned into chaos. The patient, delirious with the high fever, leaped into the aisle and almost knocked over the patient with one foot, who accidentally brought the black rubber tip of his crutch down on the other's bare foot, crushing some toes. The delirious man with the fever and the crushed toes sank to the floor and wept in pain, while other men tripped over him and hurt him more in their blind, milling, agonized stampede. "He's back!" all the men kept mumbling and chanting and calling out hysterically as they rushed back and forth. "He's back! He's back!" Nurse Kramer was there in the middle, suddenly like a spinning policeman, trying desperately to restore order, dissolving helplessly into tears when she failed. "Be still, please be still," she urged uselessly through her massive sobs. The chaplain, pale as a ghost, had no idea what was going on. Neither did Natalie, who kept close to Yusarian's side clinging to his elbow, or Hungry Joe, who followed dubiously with his scrawny fists clenched and glanced from side to side with a face that was scared. "Hey, what's going on?" Hungry Joe pleaded. "What the hell is going on?" "It's the same one," Dunbar shouted at him emphatically in a voice rising clearly above the raucous commotion. "Don't you understand? It's the same one! The same one!" Yusarian heard himself echo, quivering with a deep and ominous excitement that he could not control, and shoved his way after Dunbar toward the bed of the soldier in white. "Take it easy, fellas," the short, patriotic Texan counseled affably with an uncertain grin. "There is no cause to be upset. Why don't we all just take it easy?" "The same one," others began murmuring, chanting and shouting. Suddenly, Nurse Duckett was there too. "What's going on?" she demanded. "He's back," Nurse Kramer screamed, sinking into her arms. "He's back! He's back!" It was indeed the same man. He had lost a few inches and added some weight, but Yusarian remembered him instantly by the two stiff arms and the two stiff, thick, useless legs, all drawn upward into the air almost perpendicularly by the taut ropes and the long lead weights suspended from pulleys over him and by the frayed black hole in the bandages over his mouth. He had, in fact, hardly changed at all. There was the same zinc pipe rising from the hard stone mass over his groin and leading to the clear glass jar on the floor. There was the same clear glass jar on a pole dripping fluid into him through the crook of his elbow. Yusarian would recognize him anywhere. He wondered who he was. "There's no one inside," Dunbar yelled out at him unexpectedly. Yusarian felt his heart skip a beat and his legs grow weak. "What are you talking about?" he shouted with dread, stunned by the haggard, sparking anguish in Dunbar's eyes and by his crazed look of wild shock and horror. "Are you nuts or something? What the hell do you mean there's no one inside?" "They've stolen him away," Dunbar shouted back. "He's hollow inside, like a chocolate soldier. They just took him away and left those bandages there. Why should they do
Dunbar's
that?"
Dunbar's completely... That's it. That was the last scrap of his sanity.
"Yeah. Why should they do that? Why do they do anything? They've stolen him away," screamed someone else, and people all over the ward began screaming, "They've stolen him away! They've stolen him away! Go back to your beds," Nurse Duckett pleaded with Dunbar and Yusarian, pushing feebly against Yusarian's chest. "Please go back to your beds." "You're crazy," Yusarian shouted angrily at Dunbar. "What the hell makes you say that?" "Did anyone see him?" Dunbar demanded with sneering fervor. "You saw him, didn't you?" Yusarian said to Nurse Duckett. "Tell Dunbar there's someone inside." "Lieutenant Schmalker is inside," Nurse Duckett said. "He's burned all over." "Did she see him? You saw him, didn't you? The doctor who bandaged him saw him. Go get him, will you? Which doctor was it?" Nurse Duckett reacted to the question with a startled gasp. "The doctor isn't even here," she exclaimed. "The patient was brought... The patient was brought to us that way from a field hospital. You see," cried Nurse Kramer. "There's no one inside." "Oh no, not her too." Madness is contagious, I guess. or at least mania.
Well, look, these are the same people who witnessed
Kit Samson.
Kit Samson, McQuat situation. So I think they're all probably a little bit fragile.
"There's no one inside," yelled Hungry Joe and began stamping on the floor. Dunbar broke through and leaped up furiously on the soldier in White's bed to see for himself, pressing his gleaming eye down hungrily against the tattered black hole in the shell of white bandages. He was still bent over, staring with one eye into the lightless, unstirring void of the soldier in White's mouth when the doctors and the MPs came running to help Yusarian pull him away. The doctors wore guns at the waist. The guards carried carbines and rifles with which they shoved and jolted the crowd of muttering patients back. A stretcher on wheels was there, and the soldier in white was lifted out of bed skillfully and rolled out of sight in a matter of seconds. The doctors and MPs moved through the ward, assuring everyone that everything was all right. Nurse Duckett plucked Yusarian's arm and whispered to him furtively to meet her in the broom closet outside in the corridor. Yusarian rejoiced when he heard her. He thought Nurse Duckett finally wanted to get laid and pulled her skirt up the second they were alone in the broom closet, but she pushed him away. She had urgent news about Dunbar. "They're going to disappear him," she said. Yusarian squinted at her uncomprehendingly. "They're what?" he asked in surprise and laughed uneasily. "What does that mean?" "I don't know. I heard them talking behind a door." "Who?" "I don't know. I couldn't see them. I just heard them say they are going to disappear Dunbar." "Why are they going to disappear him?" "I don't know. It doesn't make sense. It isn't even good grammar. What the hell does it mean when they disappear somebody?" "I don't know. Jesus, you're a great help." "Why are you picking on me?" Nurse Duckett protested with hurt feelings and began sniffling back tears. "I'm only trying to help. It isn't my fault they're going to disappear him, is it? I shouldn't even be telling you." Yusarian took her in his arms and hugged her with gentle, contrite affection. "I'm sorry," he apologized, kissing her cheek respectfully, and hurried away to warn Dunbar, who was nowhere to be found.
Man. Because Dunbar was already... They were already worried, like, he wasn't quite with it, and he caused issues by pointing at the bombing the village.
Yeah, he was starting to become very, I guess the official term was would be insubordinate towards his superiors. Yes.
Yeah, and so he would have already been, like, red flagged.
But the whole thing with disappearing, I think because the hospital's got a number of CID men in there.
Yeah.
And he did just cause a mini riot.
He caused a mini riot, but also remember the guy who's in charge of the psychiatrist in charge is not particularly good.
Mm.
He's also not, like, they're all over the place in terms of who's working there. Like, he's, it's easier to make the men disappear who could make Cathcart look bad.
Or just, you know, stop everything from running smoothly.
Yeah. It's really, like, it was really disturbing. There was a bit in there that sounded a lot like when the chaplain is describing, you know, basically all you need to do for immoral things to be okay is just not be moral, basically.
Yeah, to have no character. Morality.
Have no character. And it was weird because listening to that was just like, my God, 1984. Straight away, it's like brutality is patriotism and things like that. Like, well, yeah. That's exactly it. So, yes. Oof.
Yeah, it's sad because it started out almost like, you know, even when they were going to see a Hollywood film, it seemed like that's the nice group that's left. You got Yusarian, Dunbar, Nate Lee, Hungry Joe, and the chaplain. And they all seem to be having a good time just being there away from the war in the hospital.
It's all rough.
Even Nurse Duckett was there, although she no longer has any interest in Yusarian because she's decided she's marrying a doctor.
Yeah, that's actually very big sidebar. This is not true of all nurses. In fact, it is not true of most health professionals. Mm. However, there is a culture that exists where people go into nursing or even medicine or health-adjacent things with that mentality, which is really, it's sad, but it's also possibly why we've had such walkouts in the last year. Yeah, so culturally speaking, that is a thing, and it's caused I would argue it has compromised the quality.
Mm-hmm.
But usually it's not the most sustainable motivation. Yeah. Especially, I mean, that's where, you know, we've had the crisis we've had in the last 2 years. That's really, it's not the healthiest workplace to begin with. And in this story, we're getting an inkling of it. Like, they've got super admin, like, this is the army, so, or the military, and therefore there would be also, like, extreme admin pressures. It's not quite the same thing because it's not about profit margins and whatnot, but it is about getting as many bodies out there to do the battle.
And PR is very important for them as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, yeah. So it's how you look. It's the propaganda that they can share. Well, I mean, yeah. So the whole thing.
Especially thinking about it, because, yeah, World War II, the draft was still in place. So American public at large had more of a vested interest in the wars that America decided to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. And those, like, there was the involuntary aspect to it, which is...
Well, just talking about the idea of why PR is so important, because you've got to keep selling the majority of the public on the war and the need for it.
I mean, yeah. So it's interesting. Like, we knew that they weren't well to begin with, but
mm-hmm. I mean that whole bit where it started out, where, you know, those idiots getting drunk and firing machine gun fire.
Yeah, I was a little confused as to whether this is New Year's or Thanksgiving.
It is Thanksgiving, but they were yelling New Year, Happy New Year, because they're drunken idiots.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. But also, he's just complete, like, it's just, and a lot of it seems to be Milo related. Again?
Yes. Well, funny enough, I just, before I put the Kindle down, I noticed that the next chapter is called Milo the Militant.
Well, that makes sense.
Oh, I did want to bring up where, because Yusarian made the comment that this was even worse. Well, no, he mentioned when Milo attacked the squadron, because that's why the machine gun nests were up there. So it really feels like, okay, even though that seemed like a big deal because Milo faced no consequences for it, he just set things up so if there's the next time, he's better prepared for it.
It's just, oof. Yeah, Milo's a piece of work, that's for sure.
Yeah, at the moment, if you got a scales here, you got Cathcart on one scale, Milo on the other, who do you think's worse at the moment?
They're just two aspects of the same issue. Self-serving. It's all about being self-serving.
Hmm.
And same goes with, Arfi is also, I mean, all of the ones that are really causing the major issues are self-serving. Nately is self-serving, but the way he's self-serving is because he wants to, he actually tries to stop Yusarian from getting hurt. He tries, like, he's different.
Yeah.
He actually cares. Yusarian also cares in his weird, twisted way.
Well, he's just so broken now that... I mean, you know, right after getting up there and then almost shooting Dunbar and Dunbar almost shooting him, basically all the violence just drained out of him.
Yeah.
And then he felt really bad about punching Nately.
Yeah. He's definitely lost it. But yeah, they're all not very well.
Really must have been a slug, because he's got two black eyes and a broken nose.
Yeah, that's not good. He's lucky he didn't get killed, because that's not a direction.
I'll try and be as ungraphic as I can, but it's the idea that if you push the bridge of the nose bone far enough in, it punctures the brain.
Yeah, it's not good. Very bad things can happen. But yes, Oof, it'd be interesting to find. Hopefully Milo will eventually have his comeuppance, but I don't have confidence in that.
Here's a more open question. Do you think any of the negative people in this book are going to face their comeuppance? I mean, okay, Mikwat kind of had consequences for his actions.
Yeah, but he was also not, it was more his coping strategy was harmful to others.
True, and he really, even though what he was doing was awful, not even close to the level of, like, the big four, which are Milo, Cathcart, Arfi, and Black.
I don't know. I don't know if they're going to. And, of course, not Dreadle, but the other guy.
Peckham.
Yeah. I don't think most of them are going to face consequences. It's funny that Shaiskov is technically facing consequences. Because he's been pulled away from the thing that he likes to do, and he's basically now bottom, way on the bottom of the food chain in terms of his experience.
And he's got to be working under Peckham.
Yep. And also, technically, Danica, who could have done something when he had the opportunity to do things, chose not to because he was thinking about himself.
Mm.
And he's paid the consequences for that, too.
Yeah.
Oof. So yeah, there's a little bit of that, but most of the time it's not fair.
And who was it? It was Sergeant Kolodny shot himself while drunk.
Corporal, but yes.
It was, yeah, yep.
Yeah, Corporal Kolodny, and who else? There's been a couple of...
And Gus and Wes were administering the purple gums and the laxatives to anyone who got drunk.
Well, anyone who was feeling sick or came to their tent because they were feeling sick. And that was because of, what's his name? Milo's definitely contributed to that somehow.
Hmm.
Oof. Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. Oh, dear.
Well.
Yes.
We will find out next time.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us for this, folks. We hope you enjoyed this chapter as manic as it was. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs. It's by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. At the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Roo McMoo. That's R-O-O-M-C-M-O-O. You can also find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast. That's both on Twitter and Facebook. And if you add an @gmail.com, that is our email address. And feel free to send us suggestions, reflections, experiences with bureaucratic nonsense, all these things. And that's it for me.
So until next time, enjoy your reading. Stay safe, everyone. And I'll see you in the next chapter. We'll be right back.